Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Jay Hughes, aka Dr. J, and I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Speaking today with James Chapin. Jim Chapin is the Vice Chair of the Democratic Socialists of America, Chairman of the World Hunger Year, a new political analyst for United Press International, whose articles you can read at www.vny.com. Welcome, Jim.
Hi, how are you?
Jim has a background in history and political science, and you've taught, so you have academic credentials as well, but you've been deeply immersed in the realities of politics for the last 20 years, haven't you?
More than that, it's getting close to the first campaign I was involved in, Machine McCarthy, 32 years ago now.
Well, your articles always are great because they combine a wealth of historical and political analysis with a real ongoing concern and grappling with ongoing issues. And so let's just jump into it. You have written about the current presidential campaign for UPI. What differences are there between Bush and Gore? Is it, Nader says there's no differences and the Gore people are quick to point out differences, but are these substantial differences between these two candidates?
Depends on what one's judgment about substantial is. Pretty clearly, there are serious differences between Gore and Bush on questions involving the welfare state. Bush has got a number of ways to privatize the welfare state somewhat further than it's already been privatized. Whereas, on the other hand, on questions such as international trade, foreign policy, corporate power, those kinds of questions, obviously Gore and Bush are not that different. So, depends upon what you think is substantial and what you think isn't.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've talked in your articles about the declining faith that Americans have in government as an agency of popular empowerment or the popular good. Is that a subject that which has become emblematized in this election? In other words, should people be voting for Gore to represent their support for the welfare state and Bush to represent their opposition to the welfare state? Is that what is at stake here?
Well, it's not support or opposition to the welfare state as it is. It's support or opposition to the theory of the welfare state. Mm-hmm. I quoted two very good political scientists back in the 1960s, right after the 1964 election, which was the greatest victory for the welfare state probably in history, you know, Johnson's crushing victory over Goldwater. When they pointed out even then, if you look at the American electorate is conservative in its ideology. That is to say, ask questions about, are poor people poor because they don't work hard enough? Most Americans say, yeah. Is government too big? Most Americans say, yeah. And others, theoretical questions about government, they'll basically take conservative positions. But then you ask them, do you like Social Security? They'll say, yes. Do you like Medicare? Yes. You know, do you like government agencies? Even the IRS is approved by 40% of the American electorate. And the post office, which everybody loves to make fun of, you know, more than two-thirds thinks the post office does a good job. So Americans dislike government in general, but like it in its individual parts, which then explains why the two parties have to act so differently. The Democratic Party is a party whose voters agree on what government should do, but disagree on why it should do it. Whereas the Republican Party is a party who agree about what government should be, but disagree about what it should actually do. So when Republicans come to power, they usually vowed they're going to slash government to the bone, but they usually end up only cutting its toenails because Americans actually like pretty much the government they have, but Americans also dislike the idea of government. So the Americans themselves are conflicted, and the two parties reflect that conflict.
And do you think that the partisanship, we hear a lot about gridlock, Bush is running on the claim that he's going to be, you know, build bridges on this apparently gridlocked Congress. Do you think that partisanship has actually increased in the House and the Senate over the last, say, 100 years, or has it decreased?
Partisanship runs in waves depending on ideology and actual political conflicts. I mean, obviously, there are peaks of partisanship that are reached in periods like the 30s or, for that matter, the early 70s in one level. But the fact was the two parties were confused in the early 70s. There are still many liberal Republicans and many conservative Democrats. So what's happened is by actual voting patterns, the Congress has become more partisan. But the reason Congress is gridlocked is not so much the two parties as divisions within the parties themselves. That is to say, for instance, the two parties are quite ready to coalesce around issues such as NAFTA, GATT, international trade, support for big business. The communications bill, which is an incredibly important bill, you know, which basically gave an immense amount of power to American communication corporations, basically passed without a peep. The new H-1B visa program, which is essentially allows the software companies to import workers from overseas at lower salaries and basically deport them if they don't like their salaries. Mm-hmm. For a period of 6 years, it's actually indentured servitude. That passed with only one Senate vote in opposition. So on those things, the parties come together. On what they go apart on are issues like abortion, issues like many of the social issues. And obviously, then there's some sets of issues about the nature of government which divide one party but not the other. Welfare reform was passed with the Democrats splitting it in half, whereas the Republicans were unanimously for it. On the other hand, support for many government fiscal programs unite the Democrats and divide the Republicans. So it really depends on the issue. Overall, of course, there is more partisanship in the pure sense of the way people vote in Congress. That is to say, the votes are more polarized now than they were 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Now, America is an unusual country in that we do not have a substantial representation of either a center liberal party, as a lot of European countries do, which is kind of a soft version of libertarianism, of our Libertarian Party. And we haven't had, until perhaps this election, a well-organized Green Party. Do you think that these third-party movements represent a more substantial and by the way, I'm talking with Jim Chapin. He's a political consultant for the United Press International, political analyst for them, and vice chair of the Democratic Socialist America. And we're talking about the electoral politics of the year. And the Greens seem to be running a much more substantial campaign than in the past. But there have been third-party campaigns in every presidential election. Is this different?
Well, there's no particular evidence this year that the percentage of vote that the minor parties will get will be anywhere near what it was even in the last two elections. Remember, where Ross Perot got 19% and 8% respectively. Generally, what third party, the American Constitution is very unusual in that it's set up in so many different ways to prevent the rise of third parties. We're basically the only two-party system in the world, even parliamentary systems, first-past-the-post systems. You know, that is to say, plurality vote wins all, such as Canada or Great Britain have had, multi-party systems for, in the case of Canada, since World War One; in the case of Britain, since 1868. The American presidency is part of the explanation for that. The institution of the presidency tends to force a two-party system. The way our votes are cast, the scandal of how difficult it is for third parties to get on the ballot, there are a whole set of reasons for that being the case. The most important omission, of course, in the American political system, we failed to mention, was the failure to have there be a large labor or socialist party in the country. Mm-hmm. And most every other country in the world, except Canada, where there's a minor socialist party, in all the European nations and in Australia and New Zealand and so on, one of the major parties is a labor or socialist party. In America, the socialist party's candidates were the most successful third-party candidates in our history over more time. Of the only 19 times the third parties since the Civil War have gotten even 2% of the vote, and seven of those times it was a candidate backed by the socialists. But no socialist candidate has done anything like that since 1932. I think what you find is that third parties represent groups that are unrepresented by the political system, and you can tell over time how those systems change. That is to say, all the way down to 1932, third parties were third parties of the left, because the left was unrepresented by the political system. Then the New Deal came in. And since the New Deal, then from the New Deal down through 1968, most of the third parties were third parties of the right, representing southern white opposition. And then Nixon and Reagan ate up those votes, so to speak. And then in 1980 and 1992 and 1996, we had third parties of the center. They felt unrepresented, that the two parties were too polarized. You had John Anderson, you had Ross Perot. And interestingly enough, this year, now we have both parties have run to the center, so now we have third parties of both the left and the right popping up, Pat Buchanan and Ralph Nader at mm-hmm. the same time. The last time that happened was 1948.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you look at a class analysis of American politics, working class people in the United States are generally, working class and poor people are generally more religious, more culturally conservative, less civil libertarian, and wealthy people tend to be more civil libertarian and more supportive of gay rights and so forth. Wouldn't you say that the natural political parties for such a polarization on the basis of class would be a libertarian party for the elites and or for the affluent, and a populist party, a culturally conservative populist party for the working class? Isn't that one of the great anomalies of our politics, that both of our parties have to forge multi-class coalitions out of very disparate beliefs?
Well, the way they do it, in a sense, is rather simple, which is to say, you have one party which joins together upper-class social liberals and lower-class economic liberals, which is the Democratic Party. And you have another party which joins together upper-class economic conservatives together with lower-class social conservatives. And then in power, both parties, since America is a class society, in power, both parties betray their lower-class constituents. In other words, the Democrats carry out social liberalism, but they don't carry out economic liberalism, whereas the Republicans carry out economic conservatism, but don't carry out social conservatism. That's why, in effect, if you call economic conservatism / social liberalism by its proper name, which is libertarianism, that's why the country has become more libertarian in its policies, even while the libertarians are not necessarily a majority of the country, but libertarian positions are what's held by the upper-class elites, by the media, people like that. That's what they believe. So we often hear the media liberal, on social issues, but on economic issues, they're extremely conservative.
Mm-hmm. You've also written recently about technology and politics. How do you think that mass communications, polling, and so forth are affecting politics? Is the instantaneity of the feedback mechanism between public opinion and public figures made them less ideological and more driven by short-term manipulative imagery, or has it in fact made them more responsive and sensitive to popular opinion?
Well, one could argue both, but the real problem with this is a case where technology intersects with an existing political system. Remember, the American political system, because most congressional districts are safe for one party or the other, control of Congress is decided by only about 50 House districts and maybe 10 Senate seats. And in those areas, they're decided by maybe 10% of the voters in those districts or those states. In the presidential election, we see the same thing. States like the biggest states in the Union, New York, California, Texas, everybody knows who's going to win those states, so essentially there's no competition going on in those states. Meanwhile, if you live in Michigan or Pennsylvania or so on, you've seen nothing but wall-to-wall ads. So the only votes that matter, given its sophistication of polling and everything else, the only votes that matter are about 3% of the American electorate. The other 97% of the American electorate is essentially ignored. So 3% of the electorate is getting everything that every candidate says in the debates, everything that's done, all the campaign money, everything is spent on 3% of the population. If you're one of the 10% of undecided voters in the state of Michigan or something, there's nothing too good for you. But if you're anybody who lives in the state of New York or California or Texas, frankly, nobody cares about you one way or the other. Why should they?
Which is very bizarre, because people who are undecided are generally some of the least informed and least involved, folks that...
Well, Bill Maher's line about that is that if you're still undecided by now, you're really, really dumb.
Right.
But there's actually an effect of this. The New York Times recently had an article where they applied the reading level packages that they have to say what the level of difficulty of speech or reading is so they can adjust it for school education.
Mm-hmm.
And the level of the debate, of the Lincoln-Douglas debates, Douglas spoke at a 12th grade level and Lincoln at an 11th grade level. The Kennedy-Nixon debates, Nixon spoke at slightly above a 10th grade level and Kennedy spoke at slightly below a 10th grade level. The Gore-Bush debates, they both spoke at an 8th grade level.
And Nader, I think, was pulling in at
12th grade, yes.
12th
Nader,
grade.
But that's the point. Nader's vote, the weakness of Nader's vote, and we saw this in Jesse Jackson's vote among whites, not among blacks, is the group most likely to vote for Nader are the incredibly well-educated part of the population. In other words, the typical Nader voter is somebody with a graduate school education.
Yeah. So the fact that the candidates are focusing on the undecided means that by necessity they're focusing on people who generally have lower education and are more apathetic.
Not so much lower education, as lower levels of interest and lower levels of information. In
mm-hmm.
other words, they're not... But essentially what it means is that the sophistication of all our techniques, in other words, the fact we have this continuous polling, the fact that people can identify right down to the household, who swing voters are and everything else and what they're like. Ironically, the greater and greater sophistication is applied to people whose views are less and less formed. In other words, more and more sort of vague, uncertain, and so on. So the result of the sort of weird dumbing down and the sort of strange, disassociated quality of our politics is that the politics is no longer aimed at those who are most interested or who have the most information. It's aimed at those who are least interested and have the least information.
Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, in the past, those kinds of folks would have been mobilized politically by political machines, at least in the big cities.
Everywhere, actually. In the rural area, just as likely, they had connections to politics which were ethnic or social or cultural, so that activists would have brought them to the polls. In other words, nowadays, they don't have those connections, so basically the only connection they have to other people is through television.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe the internet more, but basically it's still television at this point.
Is there any chance of the control of the House and the Senate changing with this election?
Well, I'd say the chance of the control of the House changing is pretty close to 50%. I mean, the Democrats have so many different advantages in terms of retirements, in terms of the nature of the campaign. I mean, you can generally tell which party's in better shape in a broad sense ideologically by what candidates are doing before. Candidates are like birds before a storm. You can tell if you watch them flying which way they're flying. And this year everybody's flying to the left. That is to say, they're all talking about, all the Democratic candidates, for example, are on the same wavelength as Gore, talking about pharmacy drugs and so on. Meanwhile, no Republicans are running with Bush and talking about big tax cuts or so on. So not only have there been three times as many Republicans retired in the House as Democrats, but also basically the nature of the campaign is pro-Democratic. On the other hand, since the Republicans do have an edge in the country as a whole, the Center for Voting and Democracy says that the average median congressional district in the country is 52% Republican in its normal vote. Even it's relatively difficult for the Democrats to win the House. So put those things together, the control of the House will be very close, but it's at least a 50% chance the Democrats will win it.
Mm-hmm.
In the Senate, the death of Mel Carnahan probably finishes the Democrats' chance of taking the Senate. Though it should be remembered, there are an awful lot of Republican senators like Strom Thurmond, who's I guess 98 now, and Jesse Helms, who's in very bad health, and so on. Who if they die, they'll be replaced by Democrats, the same way Paul Coverdell was earlier in the year.
I'm speaking with Jim Chapin. He's an historian and political scientist, chairman of the World Hunger Year, vice chair of the Democratic Socialists of America, and a political writer for the United Press International. And Molly Ivins has written a piece that was circulated widely by Nader supporters, which basically argues to progressive Democrats that because our presidential election is determined by an electoral college on the basis of who wins the majority of a state, that most progressives are in states that are going to go on the basis of polling, you can tell ahead of time, to one candidate or the other. Therefore, only in a handful of states should progressives swallow their conscience and vote for Gore, and the rest they can vote their conscience for Nader. Is that an argument that is cogent?
Yes, it's basically accurate. In other words, the best interpretation of the political system we have now. In other words, realistically, I mentioned New York, California, and Texas. By the way, it goes further than that. If New York or California or Texas are in a close election, the party that would normally carry them is going to lose the election anyway. That is to say, if the Republicans are going to carry California or have a chance of carrying California or New York, the election is already over. So basically, there's absolutely no reason if you live in New York or California or Texas or, for that matter, Illinois, not to vote with whoever you feel like voting for, because the election in your state has already been decided. The same thing is true in Wyoming or Alabama, so on. In other words, there's only about 10 states where people have to think carefully about what their vote means. In other words, my advice for some time to people has been, if you're in a state that's safe for either Bush or Gore, go ahead and vote for Nader if you're a progressive, or for Buchanan if you're a right winger, for that matter. But if you're the only states where your vote matters are, you know, if you happen to live in Pennsylvania or Michigan or Wisconsin or Washington State or whatever, you know, those states, and Missouri, in those states your vote matters. But in 35 states your vote doesn't matter, so you might as